Ms. Taylor. Good morning. May it please the court, I'm Rosemary Percival here on behalf of Leonard Taylor. The first point in this brief relates to the exclusion of crucial defense evidence. The court allowed the state to mislead the jury by excluding this crucial defense evidence. The timeline here was paramount. Leonard Taylor, by all accounts, left St. Louis early on November 26. If the victims were still alive at that point, he must be innocent. Angela Rowe was one of the victims. Her sister, Jeron, told the police that she saw Angela on the 27th and that she spoke with her on the phone on the 28th. Angela told Jeron that she was calling at an Amago gas station, but the court excluded that fact as hearsay. As the state argued in closing, the cell phone records here told a story. The problem was that the full story never came out. The state was allowed to distort the facts, and the defense was not allowed to present evidence that would have cured the state's distortion. One neighbor and three of Angela's relatives told the police in the days after the bodies were discovered that they had seen or spoken with Angela or one of the girls within the prior week, which would have been after Leonard Taylor left town. A neighbor said that he had seen them in the neighborhood on the weekend after Thanksgiving, and the state couldn't really use the cell phone records or the phone records to shake his story. But the state certainly tried to use the records to discredit Beverly and Sherry, who were the children's aunts. Beverly stated that she had spoken with one of the girls the weekend of the 27th. Sherry said that she had spoken with Angela on the 28th regarding plans for the upcoming weekend. Sherry told the police that she could hear the children in the background and heard one of the girls say, "I can't wait to see you next weekend." With each of these witnesses, the state then asked them to take a look at the graphs that the state had put together, which listed the phone calls made, and to look at the phone records and show where those calls appeared on the phone records. Neither of the women could find the calls on the records, so they both admitted that they must have been mistaken. Now we turn to Jeron Rowe, Angela's sister. Jeron told the police...
Wait. So they say they may have been mistaken. Was that under oath? Was that a
yes.
Okay. And your argument is that if the reason it wasn't in the records is because it was made from a payphone? Or?
Well, what had happened was the state objected to any testimony that Angela told Jeron that she was calling from a payphone at an Amoco gas station.
But that phone call was allegedly at 4 a.m. in the morning. So it's not an indication that these other phone calls occurred at that same time or from that payphone.
Right. No, I'm not talking right now about, I'm just setting the stage with Beverly and Sherry to show sort of the pattern the state presented to the jury. What we're complaining about that was excluded was simply the fact that the jury was not allowed to hear that when Jeron and Angela spoke, Angela was at a payphone. And the reason that is important is because the jury never heard that Angela ever used any other phone but her home phone. And so the jurors were led to believe that if this phone call did not show up on her home phone records, it must never have occurred. When she spoke with the police the day the bodies were discovered, Jeron told the police that she spoke with Angela on Thanksgiving. She borrowed money from her in person on the 27th, which was that Saturday, and she spoke with her on a phone at an Amoco gas station on the 28th. And she urged the police to get her phone records. They did not, but defense counsel ordered them up, and sure enough, there was a phone call to an Amoco gas station at that time. The state argued that anything that Angela told Jerwan was hearsay. Defense counsel countered that because the state was implying that if the phone call didn't show up on Angela's home phone records, they must not have spoken, the defense was entitled to show, well, it wouldn't have shown up there because she was talking from a different phone.
Now, I'm assuming the defense got the sister's phone records that showed she received a call. The defense didn't get the phone records from the Amoco gas station?
No, they didn't. But I don't think they needed to because the call showed up on Jerwan's.
Well, but you're suggesting that other phone calls came from Amoco to these other people. So they.
No, I'm not suggesting that it went to other people.
Well, I thought that was the implication, was that the phone calls to Beverly and Sherry could have been made from this, from the phone she made at the Amoco station.
Well, it's possible that there were more phone calls.
And that they could have gotten those records from the Amoco station to see what phone calls actually were made.
Well, it's possible. But really, the gist of our argument here is not so much corroborating what happened with Beverly and Sherry, but the problem is that we had proof that that this phone call did exist, and that it was with Angela, and the jury was kept from hearing that.
And you did show it was to the Amoco station through Jerwan's numbers.
Yes,
records.
There's Jerwan's phone record, which lists the phone number, and then there was a stipulation entered that number was for an Amoco gas station.
So the jury did hear that phone call took place, and there was a phone record for it.
They heard that. Jerwan's testimony that I spoke with Angela at about 4 in the morning, and then they received through a stipulation
that there was a phone record to support that testimony.
Yes.
But what was excluded?
But if you look at it from the jury's point of view, the jury hears that Angela made all these phone calls from home. There's no evidence the jury ever hears that Angela ever goes to a payphone and speaks to people from a payphone.
Well, but again, you don't know that she went to any payphone other than this one payphone, and those records could have been obtained. And you are wanting to use, you don't get the records, but you're wanting us to allow that inference that she made those other calls.
No, what I'm arguing, I think we're off track a little bit here. I'm solely arguing that the jury should have been allowed to hear that when Jerwan spoke with Angela, Angela was calling at that payphone, so that one call on the 28th could be linked to Angela.
One question I have is autopsies. There's autopsies. Don't they fix the time of death?
The autopsy does not quite fix the time of death, because initially Dr. Birch says that the victims must have died within 2 or 3 days prior to the date the bodies were discovered.
I thought it said 2 or 3 weeks.
Well, that's what
later he changes it to 2 to 3 weeks.
So what day do you think the murder took place?
I think it must have taken place sometime after the 28th.
Okay. But there's evidence there that could have occurred before the 28th. It's up to the jury to discern the evidence that's presented before them. And you're saying they didn't get enough evidence in the right form so they could come up with a different conclusion.
The defense had a statement that linked that phone call on the 28th directly to Angela.
And that's what, it's not clear from what you said before, so if you could please clarify. You said they had Jerwan's number showing she received a call from the Amoco station. But you're saying the state prevented you from showing that Angela made that call? Or what did they prevent you from showing?
What the jury heard was that Jerwan stated that she spoke with Angela on the 28th at 4 in the morning. They also heard that there's a phone call on Jerwan's phone bill at about the same time to a gas station.
But they excluded where Angela said during the phone call, I'm calling you from the Amoco station.
Right. So the jury, who's all this time has heard Look at the Angela's home phone records and see if there's a call. See if there's a call. They look, there's no call when Angela says there should be a call, because they don't really know. They don't know that Angela was at the payphone. All they know is that Jerwan made this call to a gas station, but without knowing that Angela was at the gas station,
and they wouldn't let Jerwan testify to that.
Mm-hmm. Now, and what exception to the hearsay rule allows that statement to come in?
Well, I talk about the present sense impression, but even if it is still considered hearsay, it would come in because the state opened the door to it by creating the inference that all the if there's not a call on Angela's phone records, then there was never a call.
And they argued that in closing.
They do, and if you don't mind, I'd like to point some of that out. In the state's closing, they urge the jury, look at the records here on Jerwan Rowe. She has the wrong weekend. I also asked Dan Jensen, did you go through Jerwan Rowe's records line by line? When was the last time her outgoing called the victim's house? November 23rd. So whatever the defense wants to say about Jerwan Rowe, what you know from these facts is that the last call, Charter counts only outgoing calls, the last outgoing call to Jerwan Rowe was on the 24th. That's from the victim to her sister, Jerwan Rowe. And if you look at the records, Jerwan Rowe's Sprint, which captured the incoming and outgoing, you will not find the victim's number after 11:23. Two cell phone companies, or one house company and one cell phone, there's absolutely no communication between these two women, sisters, from 11:24 ever again.
But that corresponds with the evidence at trial, though, from their point. I mean, if it is hearsay, if it doesn't get in, that was the evidence.
But it should have come in.
Well, they didn't open the door during the trial, did they?
Yes, they did.
Okay, during the trial. No, I'm sorry, prior to closing statement.
Yes, they did.
Okay.
Because
what did they do prior to closing statement?
Okay, and that's sort of why I was bringing up the pattern that they were using with the other two sisters. The aunts initially thought that they had spoken to Angela on certain dates. Then the state comes and says, well, look at the records and see, show me where there's a phone call on this home phone. And then the sister said, well, since there's no call on Angela's home phone, I must have been mistaken. We must not have spoken on that date. That's a clear implication that the state pulls from each of those two sisters. And so then with Jerwan, the jury is led to believe the same thing, which the state clearly encourages, that if the calls don't show up on Angela's home phone, there was no conversation.
And that's kind of inferential, an inferential injecting the issue, isn't it? Is there any case that goes so far that says something about that kind of an inferential injecting the issue for hearsay?
I don't see it as inferential, Your Honor. I mean, these records were so crucial.
The records are in. What we're talking about is whether her statement on the phone that I'm calling from the gas station can come in. That's not what they didn't talk about that at all. The state didn't inject that directly. It's, you're saying because they refer to the other records and no reference being made, you can infer that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just asking, is there any case that says you can make that kind of a finding of injection of hearsay by inference that way?
Well, I think a lot of hearsay comes in when, in these cases that I've cited in my brief, have come in where the state, where the defense has created a false impression with the jury that.
I thought the cases you relied on said if evidence is excluded and perhaps properly, but then if the state argues the absence of that evidence proves that the thing didn't occur, then that's improper, or vice versa. If the defendant argues the absence of evidence means it didn't occur, that's improper and you get to counter it.
Well,
but this is after trial, so you couldn't put, this is in closing, this occurred, so you couldn't put on additional evidence at that time.
Well, but what the state is encapsulating in its closing is a theme that has carried on throughout the trial, starting
during
the statement.
Okay. And the witness for which you're trying to get the statement through, that was that a defense witness?
Yes.
As I recall. And then was she asked by defense counsel on redirect if to explain why it wouldn't show in the records? In other words, on redirect, you know, they cross-examine her and they put the records in front of her and they shake her. But on redirect, did defense counsel say, well, is there any explanation why it wouldn't show on the records? For example, did she call you from a payphone?
Well, Jerwan testified by deposition in lieu of her in-court testimony. So when she was being deposed, she talks about the records. Nobody specifically questions her about the records, but I mean, the records are there that there was a call with an Amoco station.
If she wasn't there to testify, how was she gonna correct the problem anyway? Even if they opened the door, if she wasn't there to testify, how was she gonna slam it shut on them for acting improperly if that's what they did?
When you're saying the problem is that in her testimony that was excluded from the deposition, she explains that she was talking with Angela and explained she was going to be going to pick up Angela at that location.
Did you attempt to introduce that after the state, at some point during the trial, that excluded evidence after other evidence had come in? When did you attempt to get that in at trial?
There was a hearing with defense counsel at a break immediately before some of this other testimony came in. And defense counsel at that point explained, Judge, this is what they're doing. They have a theme that they're using all these phone records to show that if there was not a phone call on the records from Angela's phone, then the calls must not have occurred. Defense counsel brings that up to the court and says, this has opened the door. Their testimony so far, bringing in all these phone records to show all the calls in the state's case to and from Angela's home. They brought in the people from the phone company. They really stressed the home, Angela's home phone records.
But the evidence comes in through the witnesses. So when the witnesses, I know they're under a lot of pressure, as Judge Fisher indicated, when they say, I must have been mistaken, that's the time when you have to get in and say, what do you mean? Did you make these calls after this time? You just don't have the, I mean, when they say, I must have been mistaken, that's pretty powerful testimony from the point of the witness. Again, they're under pressure, but it's the way it works as far as cross-examination.
Right. And
they close the door by saying, I'm mistaken.
That's what happened with those two women. Jerwan was not available, so she wasn't able to go through that, but that testimony was there that should have come out, that would have said, that's the link, that's the connection to the phone.
Mm-hmm. And to follow up what Judge Price asked, he asked if you had any cases where the state inferentially injected the issue of making a negative inference so that they injected the issue to entitle you to get hearsay in. But you're taking even another step, aren't you? You're not even saying it was in the same witness's testimony. You're saying it was evidence that involved two other witnesses that inferentially created the negative inference?
Well, it's the theme that was building up. Here's the phone records. Here's all Angela's phone records. She didn't make any calls after this certain date, so she must have been dead.
Right. I understand the theme, but not only are you trying to infer the negative inference, you're inferring the negative inference from what happened with other witnesses. Is that
correct? Which started with those witnesses and continued with Jerwan's testimony. And Jerwan was the only one of those witnesses who could say.
And the other witnesses testified or before they brought in the deposition from Jerwan?
Yes. So that was already in. Jerwan was the only one who could say, well, actually, you know, who could create a link to show where phone records would have shown that there was a call made and the link that the call was to Angela at a payphone was kept from the jury.
And technologically, you could find the records from the payphone that would show a phone call to Jerwan.
And they did.
Yes, they have the record that Jerwan made a call to that payphone. But without the fact that it was Angela that she was speaking to at that payphone, it was worthless. And so the state, throughout their closing argument, says there's no evidence of any other call.
And there was some other evidence you're alleging was improperly excluded that was after the date they alleged she died? Or is
that the phone call?
The check, I thought, was also another thing?
Yes, there's a check, and there's also, The second issue relates to the state makes the other argument that because Leonard Taylor had not called Angela after a certain date, he must have known that she was dead. And so the defense asked to bring in her day planner, where she very carefully, from early in the year, has documented when Taylor was with her, when he called, and when he was away, which would have been admissible to counter the state's inference that he didn't call, he must have known she was dead. And interestingly, this fits in with the payphone issue too, because if the jurors had known that Angela used payphones at times, that would also help explain or counteract the state's inference that the lack of phone calls on her home phone show that she was already dead. It may have been that she was making payphone calls from payphones. So these items of evidence were crucial in this case. It was not an overwhelming evidence case. There was virtually no physical evidence linking Taylor to the crimes. The state made this enormous breach with this blood splatter evidence, which never proven to be blood, and it could only possibly be blood and possibly be Angela's blood, and notably another speck that was presumptively positive for blood was further tested and wasn't blood. They're reaching that way.
The defendant confessed to...
No, he did not.
To his brother?
Well, the state presents evidence from Perry Taylor that Leonard had confessed to him.
And in the confession, it included the details of the crime or the timing and all of these things, so that there...
Not the timing.
Well, there were... You're saying there was no physical evidence to tie him to the offense, but if the confession to the brother was found to be correct, it included information about the offenses and what happened, right?
It talks about there being a struggle.
Number of shots.
Yes, that there were shots fired.
You had the person who took him to the airport saw him dispose of a gun. I mean, there's other evidence besides the fact. It's not a case where it's only these timing issues, is it?
No, the state has some evidence, but it's not overwhelming. The jury deliberated for 4.5 hours, even though, you know, they were starting deliberations at 7:15 at night, but still deliberated 4.5 hours. The flurry of phone calls that supposedly started this whole thing when Leonard allegedly confessed to Perry, if the state's alleging that's when the murder happened, and yet the victim is making phone calls about 45 minutes afterwards. At the state's case just doesn't fit, and this evidence would have made a difference if the jury had known that phone call to the gas station was with Angela.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
May it please the court. Before trial, the parties, or I think the defense, took the deposition of the of Angela Rowe, the mother of the three children that were murdered, including the mother. They took the deposition of her sister, this Jerron Rowe. Now, at the time they took the deposition, I think everyone assumed that she lived in St. Louis and that she was going to be there at trial. And so during this deposition, they asked her, when's the last time you talked to your sister? First thing she says is the weekend before Thanksgiving. And the state's theory at trial was that the murders occurred. Thanksgiving was on the 25th. The murders occurred late on the 23rd, early on the 24th. That tied in with Mr. Taylor calling his brother, and tied in with the phone record showing a flurry of phone activity between Mr. Taylor and his brother, Mr. Taylor and his mother, and Mr. Taylor and a family friend. And into the next day, calls to Southwest Airlines, and the evidence showed that he eventually left on the 26th, the day after Thanksgiving, first thing in the morning on a Southwest Airlines flight. So the victim's sister says, yeah, I talked to her the weekend before, the 21st, 22nd, the weekend before Thanksgiving. Then upon further questioning by defense counsel, she said, no, I think it was the weekend. And I talked to her the weekend after. I actually saw her on the 27th, and I talked to her on the phone late on the 27th or very early in the morning, this 4 a.m. call on the 28th. And she said, I asked her, where are you calling me from? And the victim said, from a payphone. Clearly, flat out hearsay. They were offering that for the truth of the matter asserted, that the victim called her from.
What was the state's explanation of her saying she saw her sister on the 27th? And
the state's explanation for that was, in a reading of this deposition would reveal that Jerron Rowe is one of the more unreliable witnesses that
she's
you would find in the case.
She's lying about her sister's death?
Not necessarily lying, confused. And she went back and forth in the deposition. First it was before Thanksgiving, then it was after Thanksgiving. Then she said she saw her on Thanksgiving, and then she said, well, no, I guess I didn't see her on Thanksgiving, and in any event, I was too intoxicated on drugs and alcohol to even know who I saw. So it was just a back and forth with her. When she saw things, she didn't know exact dates. She was guessing at dates.
Did the state have an alternative reason for the 4 a.m. phone call?
Well, the alternative reason would be, and the evidence, so the judge allowed when it comes to time to trial, Jerron Rowe won't show up to trial. She's subpoenaed. She won't show up. There's a warrant out for her. And so they can't get her arrested on a writ of body attachment. So they, the deposition then has to do, even though it wasn't taken. Normally when the deposition would be taken in lieu of a person's appearance, all these things would be known in advance. So we're using a deposition that was a discovery deposition for trial purposes. And the judge allows in the fact that she saw her sister on the 27th, or that she claimed to have seen her sister on the 27th, and that this phone call took place. Also in evidence and undisputed was the fact that there was a phone call from Jerron Rowe's cell phone to this Amoco gas station payphone. Mm-hmm. Now,
so that's in evidence.
That
so
was
the jury can take that what it wants. I mean, it's in evidence that she said she saw her sister on the 27th, and that the telephone call occurred. So that's an evidence that could be argued by the defense.
And it was, Your Honor, and it was argued by the defense that look at this, look at the records. There's this phone call at 4 a.m. in the morning at the same time that her sister said that she was talking to her on the phone, and I part of it was that she was actually going out walking. I guess she said she was outside when she was on a cell phone, obviously, and that she was out walking. But she never saw her sister at the gas station. The only reason why she knew it was supposedly from a gas station payphone was because she directly asked her sister where she was calling from.
And the jury could deal with it as it wants. I mean, it was in evidence that she saw her sister on the 27th. She made the phone call. and that's in evidence.
Right.
Is there discrepancy also because her statement in the deposition was that her sister called her and the phone record showed she called the gas station?
Exactly. And that was one of the things the state pointed out about Ms. Rowe's confusion about dates and who called who and when these calls took place, because as she said, her sister called her from the payphone gas station, and the record clearly showed, the telephone records clearly showed that it was Jerron Rowe who called that payphone. But even despite all that, the defense argued that that was the evidence of that phone call when she was talking to her sister.
Now, you say here that the Siobhan was impaired. Was there evidence at trial that she's impaired on alcohol and drugs?
Well, she herself said on Thanksgiving Day, when she said she had seen her sister on Thanksgiving Day, now other family members, or at least one other family member, testified that no one saw Angela Rowe or her children on Thanksgiving Day, but Jerron Rowe said during the deposition that she saw her on Thanksgiving Day. Then later in the deposition, she backed up and said, well, maybe I didn't. I was too intoxicated that day to know. She also had two convictions, one for trafficking, one for possession of controlled drugs. She was trying to avoid showing up to trial because there was a warrant out involving maybe the trafficking drugs issue or another drug issue. So there was
evidence.
That's
not as relevant as her saying that she was intoxicated.
Well, she didn't say, there was nothing in the deposition that she said she was intoxicated at the time of this 4 a.m. phone call.
The state's position on her date of death is consistent with other evidence, such as the newspapers piling up in the driveway and her failure to show up to work despite her good work attendance.
Right. That and not only did Mr. Taylor, Judge Breckenridge mentioned that admitting to his brother that he had done all this, but he also admitted to his sister-in-law. Mr. Taylor, of course, I guess, lived with the victim and her children part of the time, but he was Mr. Taylor was actually married to a woman who lived in California, and he told his sister-in-law, who took him to the airport, the same sister-in-law, the sister of his wife, the same sister-in-law who saw him throw the gun into the sewer, he told her also that she wouldn't be seeing him, she wouldn't see him alive after today, that she was going to hear some things that would be on the news about him, but don't believe any of that. So that, coupled with the direct admission to his brother of what he did, the phone records are also important in the sense that, not necessarily that Mr. Taylor wasn't calling, but the fact that Angela Rowe made frequent telephone calls, up to 30 some a day from her home phone. There was some other evidence in the record that she had a cell phone at some point, but in, I believe it was August, 3 months or 4 months before the murders, that the cell phone was terminated or disconnected, so she didn't have that anymore. And she made numerous phone calls from her home phone. And it shows at about the time the state theorized that the murders occurred, those calls dropped off to near nothing. And the last several calls that were made after the time the state believed the murders occurred were calls made to appellant's brother, appellant's family friend, and Southwest Airlines. After that, all the calls are forwarded to voicemail up until the point and when the bodies are discovered, which was completely unusual when you compare the pattern of phone calls before the time that we believe the murders occurred. So along with all that evidence, and Mr. Taylor's brother, who there's a video will be filed with the court, it's Exhibit 196A is the entire interview between Mr. Taylor, Perry Taylor, Mr. Taylor's brother, and the police. Then the 196B is a redacted interview that was played for the jury. At trial, Mr. Perry Taylor is subpoenaed and he comes to testify. He denies making any of these statements to the police, despite the fact that there's a DVD with him making all these statements. Then he claims that the the police made him make these statements. If you watch, it's difficult to describe in a brief or in writing how, but if you watch this DVD and the one that was played to the jury, and in fact the entire one that the court viewed in determining which portions, and of course all that came in as a prior inconsistent statement when he denied ever making the statements, it's patently clear that Mr. Taylor was not being coerced by the police in making the statement.
In an interrogation room?
I'm sorry?
Was he in an interrogation room?
He was in an interrogation room.
And were a number of police in the interrogation room? Or?
Two plainclothes detectives were in the room with him.
Detectives. Plainclothes were not.
Right, he knew they were detectives.
Right.
But
and he was in the police station being interrogated.
And he was in a police station being interrogated.
And did he have an attorney or anyone helping him?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Did he have an attorney with him at that time?
No, he didn't have an attorney with him. He wasn't being charged with anything.
Well, I know, but taking a statement.
I think the belief was that Leonard Taylor, the appellant, had committed these murders, but they wanted to know what his brother knew, obviously, because they had phone records and they knew there was this flurry of activity, this phone activity between appellant and his brother. If you look at the video, what Mr. Perry
but
Taylor.
The defense of the video would be, even though he's not being charged, he's not being Mirandized or anything else.
He was.
It could be a coercive environment.
He was Mirandized, Your Honor.
He was, but okay. So he didn't ask for an attorney.
Well, and all I can say is the jury viewed the video.
But the brother's not being charged with anything.
Right. No, his brother wasn't charged with anything.
But it still could be a coercive environment in which his confession, his statement is taken.
Well, all you can do, and the jury viewed the video, I've seen it, I'm sure Ms. Percival's seen it, it just doesn't come across as a coercive environment that described by Mr. Taylor at trial, that why he said, they told him to say what they wanted him to say. Well, he's volunteering information, he's adding details, it just didn't appear to be the way that he said. And of course, the jury was the final arbiter on the credibility of all this. Just like when the children's father's sisters testified, Beverly Connolly and Sherry Connolly, about when they told police immediately during the beginning of the investigation that they talked to Angela Rowe or one of her children after the time that appellant had flown out of the state, they were shown some phone records, and I guess they were asked about that at trial. They were subpoenaed by the defense to testify. Did you tell the police this? Yes, that's what we told the police. Then on cross-examination, the prosecutor showed them the phone records, asked them if they thought about it, and they said, well, obviously we were mistaken because the phone records showed there was no telephone calls. And in fact, one of the witnesses remembered differently because of a trip her husband had taken and remembered that it had to have been before the date of the murders rather than after the theorized date rather than after. And the jury's there. The jury assesses all that credibility. The jury, in looking at the deposition and listening to the testimony that was read in from Juwan Rowe, assessed that credibility, upon reading the deposition, you can clearly understand why the jury discounted her testimony that she actually saw her sister on the 27th, or that this phone call on the 28th was her sister calling her.
Now, you took a deposition of Juwan, so a defense attorney could have asked questions with the thought maybe she won't show up, as if it would be for trial. Is that correct?
They
could have rehabilitated the witness at the deposition.
Well, I believe that it was the defense that took the deposition.
Defense took the deposition. Mm-hmm.
Right. On the what the state argued, the state never argued. They argued that based on these phone records, based on the phone records of Angela Rowe's home phone and Juwan Rowe's cell phone, that there were no calls after after the 24th. And they argued that, and that's what the argument entailed. When they said there was no communication, that was immediately preceded by the comment between these two phones. They never argued that there was not a phone call made to the gas station from Juwan Rowe's cell phone. Most importantly, and the cases that they're relying on where the state obtains exclusion of evidence and then later argues during closing that there's no evidence of this, those cases don't apply here. If the state would have argued in closing that this phone call to the gas station never existed and that there is no evidence that Angela Rowe called her sister from a gas station payphone, then the holdings in those cases might have been implicated. But the state never goes there. It confines its argument to the records of Juwan Rowe's cell phone and Angela Rowe's home phone. When in the argument, in those cases that they rely on, one involved, I think Weiss involved, documents that the defense actually had, they could not provide a foundation for, and in the court's opinion, I believe it's Judge Stith's opinion, on the Western District, the prosecutor even says, I'm trying to hide these documents. And so the court excludes them for lack of foundation, and then in closing argument, the prosecutor argues, they have no documents, they have no evidence of this particular, and it involved a buyout to explain why the defendant had all this money that came into his bank account. Lulif was a receipt that the defendant actually had at trial. The judge excluded it. I think it was a combination of late disclosure and hearsay, and the judge excludes it at the prosecution's behest in closing argument, and it was a stealing case, and the defendant claimed he had a receipt for the purchase of the stolen property, and at closing, the prosecutor argues, where's the receipt? Where's the receipt for this? Those cases are clearly distinguishable from this case. The prosecution never argued there was no evidence that Angela Rowe called from a cell phone. The jury, based on the defense closing argument, was clearly left with the impression that was not countered by the state other than the fact that Juwan Rowe was mistaken about the dates that she talked to her sister, but it was never contradicted that a cell phone or that a phone call to this gas station was made by Juwan Rowe. Though in her deposition she claimed that actually her sister called her from the gas station payphone. Again, all credibility issues that were apparently or obviously resolved by the jury at trial. Unless the court has any other questions about that or any of the other, I ask you to affirm the convictions and sentence. Thank you, Your Honors.
Opposing counsel is correct. The jurors should have been the ultimate arbiters of credibility, and they should have heard this fact that would have corroborated Juwan, whose credibility was so challenged by the state. The link between Angela and that phone call would have shown that Juwan knew what she was talking about, that there was a phone call to the gas station, Angela was at the gas station, it links it all together. And whether or not 2 years after the fact, Juwan thinks that Angela was calling her or she was calling Angela, that would be a question of credibility for the jury, which the state then could argue that because of that fact, you shouldn't believe Juwan. But certainly in a case of this magnitude, where the state uses the phone records so extensively to keep the jury from hearing evidence that would link the phone records to Angela for that one crucial phone call to show that she was alive and the phone records show it, was just devastating.
Of course, you could argue at closing, she's there, she's talking to her sister, She's saying she talked to him 27th, whatever else is there. She's an eyewitness.
But there's no proof of it. And because of her convictions, that's true. But because of her convictions, because other people have been confused about their dates, you know, the state is able to convince the jury that Jerwan, too, must have been confused about not only the phone call, because there is no phone call on the 28th to Angela's home phone record. There is no phone call on those records. And so she must be mistaken about the 28th, and is probably mistaken about the 27th. If the jury had known that, well, she wasn't calling from her home phone, she was calling from this pay phone, it would have made a big difference.
What's the context that the evidence came in that there was a phone record at that time to the gas station? How did that evidence get in?
The jury had Jerwan's phone records, and it had a stipulation that that was to an Amoco gas station. But without anything on the record that Angela ever spoke from a payphone, the jury was led to believe that all her calls would be recorded on her home phone. And with these closing arguments, I keep going back to them, but the state, I would disagree with opposing counsel's characterization of the closing argument. Angela Rose calls to Jerwan, stop on this date, that is correct. Jerwan Rose calls, stop on this date, that is correct. You'll never see Angela's number on there after the 23rd. No, you won't, because she was calling from the payphone. But the jury didn't get a chance to hear that she was calling.
But independently, it's relevant that they no longer called when they had been calling previously. So they have a right to make that argument that isn't it unusual that there's no more calls coming out of the home phone after this date?
Yeah, well, it's unusual if you know that, if you don't know that she was calling from other places.
Well, they would have a legitimate reason to make that argument, irrespective of your complaint here.
They have a legitimate claim to say when the phone calls took place, but they don't to say that there were no phone calls between these two women, because the state knew that Angela was at that payphone, and the only reason the jury didn't hear it was because the state had it excluded. And in a case of this magnitude, that just was inexcusable. All of these women, you know, we talk about different aspects of the state's case that are stronger, but there's certainly plenty aspects of the defense that's strong. You know, for five people, we have the neighbor who's saying they saw the victims after the date Leonard left, and these three relatives who are talking to the police about events that have happened in the past week, when they've spoken with, and they're all consistent with each other. There's also one of her best friends tells the police, and then a year and a half later restates it at her deposition. I know I talked to her on the evening of the 24th because it was the day before Thanksgiving, and I was making Thanksgiving dinner. At trial, she changes her mind, but there's plenty of evidence that support the fact that these murders happened later. Talking about Perry Taylor, yes, he eventually gave a statement to the police implicating his brother, but that was after he had been pulled over by the police in Georgia, in New Jersey, and finally in Missouri. He was threatened with charges himself. The police told him you should consider it a threat. And there were discrepancies within his statements. He lied about when he got back to Missouri. He lied about going to the victim's house.
But that was before the jury.
Yes, it was. And as it should have been. The parties were able to flesh out all those facts, but there's facts favorable to the defense that the jury never heard that were crucial. And I'd ask you to reverse. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The case is submitted.